Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. At the moment, we're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, the big housing conversation took place a couple of weeks ago here in Bristol. We speak to various people who attended it from the housing sector in the city, and also we hear from the Mayor, Marvin Rees, and from the Cabinet Member for Housing, Paul Smith. Also, what ever happened to British technology? David Guinness was on this show on the 22nd of June talking about Yugoslavia. But here he is this week talking a bit more in-depth about the brain drain. And also, why tidal power is so much more suited to the Bristol Channel than nuclear at Hinckley. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft just off Jamaica Street on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. You can also go to Volunteering Bristol's website. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or even to the national do-it.org website. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with the big housing conversation. It took place at the Council House. One of the keys, really, to the election manifesto for the Labour Party, Marvin Rees and the Labour Party, taking over the City Council back in May. And I spoke to several people before they went in.
So I'm Stephen Lefrenew. I'm the Student Living Officer at Bristol Students' Union. Yeah. Just come in to feed into the housing planning for the next few years. We want to make students part of the conversation.
What's things like for students at the moment?
Well, according to our latest survey, pretty poor. I mean, students are living in quite poor quality housing quite often, being charged a lot of agency fees and being ripped off from their deposits and that kind of thing quite often. That's why we're here.
Matt Strange, I'm a community organiser with Acorn in St Paul's, very politically active. I care about housing a lot because of how it affects everything else. Well, safe shelter and security affects mental health, it affects your chances in life, your opportunities, stability of education. Also access to community, rising rents or gentrification, whatever you call it, displaces communities, moves people away from their support structures, their networks and essentially degrades their living experience.
So what are you hoping from tonight?
I don't ever have many expectations from anything like this, but what I'd hope is some consensus that things have to change and there has to be a bottom-up approach to delivering some of the solutions. I think people that are affected most by this need to be included in these conversations. Longer down the road, we need to probably include more people in this conversation in order to deliver solutions, but yeah, I think it's a good start. I'd like to see a city-wide tenants federation. And I'd like to see some innovative, creative solutions that involve everyone on a citywide level in delivering temporary solutions, permanent solutions, sustainable solutions, eco-solutions. We need to especially look at the people that have relationship with people with complex needs, people that have service needs, mental health needs, because you can come out with these solutions, but we have to be careful because if you look across the country, there's been temporary solutions that have ended up being permanent solutions. For me, maybe, a little eco-home, a little shed is perfect, but if you move a family into that, well, maybe that's not so good.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
No.
My name's Adam. I think the reason we're here is we're trying to stand up for the people who don't get a word in edgeways about being homeless or being on the housing list and trying to get into the housing. This city is littered with lots of empty buildings. If we can get them back into use, whether making sort of semi-permanent housing for people who are homeless or get them or purchase them, like they can poultry purchase buildings to get them back into use, turn them into housing of some sort. There's even like factory sites, hard bit of land that can be altered. My experience is that seeing people around Bristol who are homeless and don't have any choice but end up in that situation, to black mark them as being a problem is while they're trying to solve the problems by getting them off the streets and then give them a start. I mean, they've been living on the streets for a while, probably some of them for quite a long time. They've got habits that they need to deal with or change their ways to have a normal life.
But the City Council will say, well, there's not enough money for all that.
Well, I say that I'm sure they could come up with some scheme to get people involved in in doing it themselves. If and there's plenty of people out with skills out there. If even if you like people involved to rebuild houses or work on empty buildings that are need work, and if they can at the end of it do them up, they can probably either get them or get them on a cheaper rate or something, work it off, that they can actually live in them by the end of it. So I mean, people can build, do stuff themselves if you give them the tools to do it.
Have you been homeless yourself, and how have you sorted that out, if you have?
I haven't been homeless myself, but I know people who have become homeless and people who are homeless, and it's sometimes not your own fault, you know, whatever reason you might end up in that situation. But to give people the tools to get off that, from that situation, which with all these empty buildings in the city, it's as this a shock to see them empty when they could be used, even if they're just someone sleeping in there, like they do with them. Some companies do a thing where they do very cheap rent on places.
We've even got some brand new flats in the city centre, completely empty, half block down at in the centre, near where the old brewery is.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I mean, they shouldn't be empty. They're new buildings, they should be empty. I mean, I've heard stories about some in London where they did a thing about some company that left some buildings empty, and there was a big process about it, and they said, like, look at them, they're always brand new, and they took them from being empty back into use, because some of these buildings are usable, they're not being used. And if the council can get involved with the owners to get them to put them back into use.
Well, the council also owns quite a lot of property themselves.
Yeah, they should put them back into use themselves. They should do. They should, you know, get any buildings, whether it's, you know, a temporary solution. It doesn't have to be smart and clean and tidy. It could be just something that someone can sleep in for the time being. If you've got someone homeless sleeping in there, and it's safe to live in, then they're homed, and it costs them any money to do it, and it gets people off the streets, gives them some sort of warm bed and somewhere nice to go, and it sort of gets them out of the situation they're in. And that's game 101 problem of the homelessness.
I'm Richard Drake. I'm from the Dune Trust Night Shelter, and I'm here because homelessness is part of the issue of the big housing question, and I want to make sure it's properly represented. We're doing a lot this year through the Rough Sleeper Partnership in solving that problem. I don't want to see people living on the streets, but we also need to understand that some people don't want to engage with the services that are there to help them, and that's a challenge to everybody. You only need to look on a global scale at Calais to understand the issues of that. There are some people who are quite difficult to help because they present themselves to people who haven't got the resources to help them in that number, in that place at that time. You can't just turn up on somebody's doorstep and say, let me in, I need a bed for the night. That doesn't work.
You've been doing this for a while now.
Yeah.
How have you seen things change over the last maybe 5-6 years or so?
More people on the streets, more problem drug use, although that's ebbed away a bit with the spice and the legal high stuff. That was a particular problem which didn't help deal with some of the people. But also, we've seen a lot more public engagement with the issue and a lot more practical solutions to helping people get through and into housing.
Do you think it's possible to house all the homeless in Bristol?
Yes, by working with them as individuals and finding the right solution for them.
But the council got the cash to help?
It's not just a case of cash, and it's not just a case of the council. It's helping prevent homelessness. I mean, when we talk about the people we see on the streets, they haven't just suddenly appeared on the streets. They've been through some sort of life journey that's ended up like that. I think a lot more people need to understand the risks of homelessness much earlier in the process, seek help, which is there from people like Citizens Advice for young people, 16, 25 independent people. People need not to be in denial about the risks of homelessness to themselves. So when they're getting into debt, when they're running behind in rent, when their relationship's breaking down, when they're falling out with mum and dad, they need to be thinking, I could end up on the streets. Not, it's going to be all right, it's not going to happen to me. Seek help early, then they don't end up on the streets before. You know, it's much easier to help them if you catch them before they end up in the bear pit, you know, sharing cans of cider.
I'm Cleo Lake. I'm the deputy leader of the Green Group in Bristol, and I'm a Green Councillor for Cotton Ward. I think it's a crucial aspect of life at the moment. It always is, obviously, housing, very, very crucial. A lot of things happening at the moment, lots of things happening in Bristol. I'm also part of a subgroup within the Green Party looking at housing, so that's very much one of my areas of responsibility within the group. And, yeah, I want to see how we can work together to find solutions to the crises that are going on. One of my colleagues, Carla Denyer, has been in the press today, actually, challenging and trying to get more kind of licensing for private landlords. So that whole thing about people not having security where they live, which is in some sense quite unique to the UK. We're very sort of landlord-led, really, and, you know, money, it's all about money at the end of the day, isn't it? Which, sadly, money over people. And just being able to give people that security and also have decent living conditions. Me personally as well, I'm looking at alternatives. And, you know, we've had quite a lot of travellers in Bristol recently. And I'm thinking, well, is there somewhere where people can live? Why can't we have the right to land, the right to air, the right to water, all these things that should be under universal and natural law, free?
You go to the council who have this responsibility to house people and they say, sorry, we haven't got the money.
Yeah, it's a challenge, and as we know, there's more money to find, and it's about how we can find tangible solutions to challenge all of this, challenge austerity, challenge the lack of housing. How can we build more homes? More recently, you know, a few months ago, there was the sell-off of the council properties, and I went along to a few of those protests, and actually at the auction itself, and now it's about, okay, so at the time under the last administration, we were told those properties were not fit for purpose. There were disputes about that, and that the money raised from that would be reinvested, i.e. in where I live in St. Paul's, the money would be reinvested in providing social housing in that area. And it's about holding to account now, well, where is that money? Has it just gone into a big pot? And where is the housing that should be delivered? When you dig into things, sometimes for common sense people among us, you think this doesn't make sense. And I think sometimes institutions have been led by habit almost, and it's just the way things are, and that's how they're going to carry on without perhaps a little challenge. I do hear, you know, people saying that officers perhaps have too much power, but I really feel that elected officials and councillors will have more weight under this administration. I'm quite confident about that. And I think, you know, I kind of forgot your question now, to be honest.
But it was just about, we've had years of inaction. What makes you think anything might change now?
I think because we have to look at budgets. I mean, Acorn have done a fantastic job of highlighting issues, helping people as well, and empowering people to take some sort of control or challenge. And I think, you know, the sheer amount of money, and I knew this anyway through a friend of my mum's who was in temporary accommodation, the amount of money that costs and the amount of money that's been dished out to people who are providing, in a lot of cases, inadequate accommodation, it just doesn't make sense. We have recruited a new strategic lead on finance, and I'm quite confident this person brings a lot of experience and vision and is someone who really wants to tackle and deliver on the ground and then make the finances add up for that. So I think that is also a kind of breath of fresh air, and I think it's a step in the right direction.
That was several participants at the big housing conversation here at Bristol City Council's City Hall. And now we'll hear from Marvin Rees, the Mayor, and also from Paul Smith, the Cabinet Member for Housing, at the big housing conversation, introducing it themselves.
This evening, I'm Marvin, obviously elected mayor of Bristol. And before the election, when we were a candidate, I was talking to the guys from Acorn, and just said, to be honest, it's taken a little bit longer than we planned. We hoped to do it in the first 3 weeks, but we got it done. We said what we'd really like to do is bring the tenants' voice into the council house with some of the people in the city who are taking the lead on how we get homes built, how we take measures to protect people in the private rental sector, how we manage our lets across council housing and housing associations as well. And a couple of key, a few key ideas around that. One is to do what Paul described as really empowering the tenants' voice in Bristol. So how we quite do that and how we continue that, we need to work it out. But I think it certainly starts with bringing people into City Hall and making sure that the testimonies are heard and the conversations that are happening around housing in Bristol are fully informed by that. I think that the second piece for me that's really important is that it's a real motivator. You know, I was overseas just recently, and someone described to me when they took over New York with Mayor Bloomberg, they said the first year it felt like they just had their mouths around a fire hydrant. Everything came at them. And I think it's very important for the leadership, for myself, for Paul and for the wider cabinet and member of our elected members who are here from all parties as well, is to be reminded of the scale and the urgency of the demand that Bristol takes concrete steps to solve, to address and to solve the housing crisis that we face. And we know the implications, okay? It's about the personal tragedies. It's about children not having a solid place to start their home. It's about the insecurities that people face and the overflows that has for physical health and mental health. But it's not just, and often when I talk about issues of race equality, of course we can have the moral discussion, right? It's the right thing to do. But we've got to talk about social justice now, making economic and political sense. That poverty, inequality, poor social policy costs us money. The false economy of the cuts is a classic example. But if we run a city in a way that makes people sick, if we run a city in a way that undermines the stability of our communities, this turns up as costs to the city, both directly in terms of public services, whether it be school interventions, mental health services, the need for public health interventions, the need for support services, or the cost to the voluntary community sector that need to step in. But I would also say that this is a private sector issue as well. And it should be among the enlightened self-interest of our business community in Bristol to say, how do we build the kind of city on which we can build a strong economy, on which we can build a strong future? A city that will give us the foundations for bringing forward the kind of workforce that businesses need and will be able to attract inward investment to the city for our future development. So we've made a number of commitments. I'm just going to read a little bit just to share with you some of the scope for some of the commitments we're making that you can bear in mind today. Obviously, we made a commitment to get Bristol building at least 2,000 homes a year by 2020, at least 800 of those affordable. We committed to adopting a no second night out policy around homelessness, and actually this Christmas we're working with a collection of city institutions to say what would happen if we as a collection of city institutions across local government, health, business, voluntary community sector, criminal justice, what happened if we just mobilised around the issue of street homelessness? So we'll make an announcement in the coming weeks around taking an initiative on street homelessness for Bristol, particularly for this winter period. We've talked about working with our colleagues across council about bringing greater clarity and certainty to the planning process around housing, and making sure that in the process of developing housing as well, we're looking at how it drives into the local economic multiplier, training up our local workforce to be building the homes that Bristol people need. And again, it's an issue of social justice, but as we look at the rebalancing of the financing of local government and the reduction of the money coming from central government, making sure we have a base for council tax is going to be essential to making sure that we're viable. But I would say this, you know, and in the tables that come, this event is about you and hearing your voice. It's going to be the first of a series. We talked about the frequency with which we can organise these. We'll do this one today. What I'd like to do is do another one in 4 months, another one 4 months after that. We don't need to do them every 4 months, but I think certainly as we get our administration going, it would be good to have a little bit of a concentration of discussions with you, so you can constantly be feeding back to us on what is happening on the ground and where we need to be focusing, and where we can share with you what we are doing and what challenges we may be facing, and where we're likely to see some successes and what changes you can expect to see. So I hope that you'll consider this an open door. I think it's really fitting. I didn't design it like this, but I have a very very clear memory of being in this building, probably in here, because I'm told this is where people come to pay their rent, as a young brown boy with a single white mum paying our rent, with people being very rude to her because we didn't own our house and we were poor. So I think in some sense there's something very poetic about reclaiming this place now, but for Tenants' Voice today, this is the start of rebalancing that sense of power and leadership in the Bristol. So like I said, please consider this an open door. We have every intention of living up to the standards. That's why we ran for selection. But help us identify the solutions. We know the challenges. Help us identify what we need to do to make some real progress. And I'd now like to invite Paul Smith to the stage, and again it's a clear statement of our intent that we have a political lead specifically on housing, and Paul is a local, regional and national reputation for expertise on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Marvin. It's always a hard act to follow, although I believe Peter Andre is currently in galleries, but you've got me. God, show us your six-pack. No, so, obviously, we don't need to say there's a housing crisis in Bristol. We all know it. We can see it every day. It's in the news every day. We can see it in the statistics. I'm not going to quote statistics at you because, apart from being pretty horrendous, it doesn't actually really achieve very much. But also for social housing. We have actually got a government at the moment which has declared war on social housing. But just to give you a few of the ideas or a few of the things that we face as challenges, the government is forcing council housing to reduce its income, to get it into a position where it has to cut back on repairs, where it can't do building, and cut back on its services. It's going to make councils pay for the right to buy for housing association tenants, and the government, to get us to get that £20 million a year for them, is going to force us to sell off our higher value properties when they become empty. Also, the government have given, and the previous coalition government gave, developers a get out of jail free card for providing affordable housing in their schemes by allowing them to prove that it's not viable to have affordable housing. And the amount of affordable housing being delivered through the planning system is pitifully low. And in general, what we're looking at is a system which is basically saying social housing in some way is something that we shouldn't have. We've got council tenants on benefits who are being put in a position that they are not getting the full cost of their rent. Their benefits are being cut back, particularly if they've got families of three or more children, through both the benefit cap, others being affected by the bedroom tax. And if council tenants have the audacity to work, they will have to pay higher rent. Those higher rents won't go to the council, they'll go straight to the government. So that's the circumstance we're in. And obviously in that sort of political position, you could say, well, let's just give up. There's nothing we can do. Things are only going to get worse. But we don't want to buy into the politics of despair. And I just want to say a little bit about the priorities I've set for this year, the progress we've made so far. It's not enough. It probably never will be enough. And also some of the challenges for the coming years where we'd really like to hear your views. Obviously, there are things that you will want to give us views on which aren't on this list. That doesn't matter. And you might decide that the things I'm raising are not important. That's fine. It's for you to say. But in terms of the four priorities, the first one, Marvin said, is to increase house building, and particularly to increase the amount of new affordable housing. We've just agreed it's going out to the public in the local area in a few weeks' time, so I can't say where. The biggest new council house building site for about 30 years. That will be 60 homes, which might not sound a lot, but in terms of what's been managed before, it is quite a lot. It's on a site that the previous administration had put on the for sale list. We've also got three of our sites going out to housing associations to deliver social housing. And we're also bringing forward a number of sites that have been zoned for housing for decades, but nothing's ever been built. And in fact, I've taken a lot of flack on that. Some of those are sites that, you know, that people maybe don't want housing on, places like Hengrove Park, which has been in the news today. But sorry, if a site is designated for housing, and it has been for decades, we're going to have to build some housing on it. Obviously, we're going to work with the local communities to make sure it's housing that's acceptable and that it's set in a good setting. But we need more new affordable housing across the whole of the city, not just in pockets. So we will be pushing to bring more and more sites through to be built. We want the second priority is to reduce the number of council empty homes. We've got to look at the processes, why it takes so long at the moment for the council to get its homes through, look at the resources for getting them out. And we've got four charities are actively talking to us about taking some of those empty homes on, homes that under the previous administration would have been put out to auction. So we are looking to make the best use of the properties we've got. For me, it's criminal that we've got so many empty properties owned by the council. We're working already on empty homes in the private sector, but we've got to walk the walk. We can't just tell the private sector they've got to do it. We've got to do it ourselves as well.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
David Guinness is a member of the Guinness family. He went to Eton and he was on the show back on the 22nd of June talking about Yugoslavia. But here he is talking about the brain drain in the 1960s mainly, and also tidal power. Because he's an engineer, he's interested in these things, and he believes tidal power is far, far better to have in the Bristol Channel than nuclear at Hinkley. So here's David Guinness. Whatever happened to British technology?
My name's David Guinness. Now, you can probably guess by my name that I was born into a wealthy, upper-class family. And the thing that really turned me on was making model aircraft. And we put engines on them, and they flew. And they flew so fast and far that we had to chase after them on Chobham Common. So that's how I first got interested in engineering. But I was born into the upper class. I was sent to Eton, school for scoundrels. Well, I left thinking that I was a superior human being. And inequality was built into the whole structure of Eton. By clothes, social status at Eton was judged by sports, whether you were good at sports. And if you were good at athletics, you wore one cap. If you were good at football, you wore another cap. In the summer, you'd wear a blazer. Quite frankly, I was useless at sports because I had terrible sight. I had a squint. I had to play squash by myself. It was ridiculous. Discipline was largely exercised by the senior boys. In my house, Eton was divided into houses of 50 or 60 boys. And my house was run by the library, it was called, of six boys. And I was beaten repeatedly, and people used to put blotting paper in their trousers to reduce the pain of the cane being administered.
I mean, was there any sort of justice, do you think, in the way that it was used?
Well, as far as I was concerned, no. I could never understand why I was beaten. They said to me, every time you come in here, you've got some excuse, and I don't know. I was beaten for one of the things I did at Eton was to build a 14-foot sailing boat. That was in the School of Mechanics, and I was found in the School of Mechanics out of hours, so I was beaten for that.
So then you went into National Service. How long was that? And that was, everybody had to do that, didn't they?
I was in for about 18 months because I'd got a guaranteed place at Cambridge and they let me out early so that I could start the September term at Cambridge. But how I became an officer, I simply don't know. Part of it was parading up and down Buckingham Palace wearing a basket and a scarlet tunic and me issuing commands to my platoon. The whole thing didn't do anything for me at all because my interpersonal skills, frankly, by the time I left the army were approximately zero.
But you come from a military family.
I was from a military family. And yet I couldn't make sense of it all. We had the Christian church, which talked about loving your neighbour, and that didn't exactly mean killing your neighbour. But that was what I was brought up to do. I was born into a very military family. My uncle was Marshal of the RAF, Sir John Slessor. a cousin of my mother's was Lord Portal of Hungerford, who was in charge of the Battle of Britain. There were politics throughout my upbringing. My godmother was the granddaughter of Sir Robert Peel. My godfather, Charles Doughty, was an MP. And my father always wanted to be an MP, but never could, because he was a sort of emotional invalid, really. He had a breakdown in China, I think, when his mother died, and he never really recovered from that.
After National Service in Eton, you got into engineering. How exactly?
Well, I had a false start at Cambridge trying to read mathematics. Couldn't do it, so came down. So went back to read engineering. And engineering at Cambridge was incredible. The engineering schools were so well equipped. I mean, we did practicals on engines that came out of rovers. There was an enormous submarine engine, a submarine electric motor, which we did practicals on. We're talking about 1959 there. Anyway, I got a degree. Then I got a job in electronics, and it was Hawker Siddeley Dynamics, which was involved in making guided missiles. And I loved electronics. I can remember one Christmas where I asked permission to work over Christmas because I enjoyed it so much. And during that time, I designed the electronics for the first laser-guided homing head. At that point, I felt I was saving the world from communism. Hawker Siddeley Dynamics were at Hatfield, had a huge runway and aircraft could land on it. We would test the design at Farnborough. The basic thing of it was shining a laser at a target. It was an extremely powerful laser. We had to wear green glasses to protect our eyes. And an aircraft would fly over with the laser-guided missile and home on the target that was being irradiated by the laser. And I reckon that that was used in the Falklands War. I think I was one of the first people to work on it. I mean, I was working in the Advanced Projects Department of Hawker Siddeley Dynamics, and we had people from the Ministry of Defence coming up to see what we were doing. They, of course, were very pleased. But I must say, now, I reckon someone making the atom bomb said he'd known Sin. Well, I think I'd known Sin, designing this homing head. In Hawker Siddeley Dynamics, we were doing firsts. We made a guided missile called Martel, codename AJ-168. We made infrared-seeking guided missiles, which were sent off in the direction of an aircraft and then home on the heat coming from the engines and blow up the aircraft.
So whatever happened to British engineering? In the 1950s, late 50s, early 60s, it looked like Britain was leading the world.
Well, look, I think I'd better digress, because it was the time of the brain drain. And I got a job with Chrysler Corporation working on the US space program. That was an absolute eye-opener to me. It was an eye-opener to me because I was working with American engineers. And they held themselves high, they were enjoying themselves, they were in contrast to British engineers who always had a moan about something. But I'll come to that later, if I may. Now, I spent a year on the space program. If I hadn't spent a year there, I'd have had to have repaid my travelling expenses across. But then I did an extraordinary thing. which was to go to an American business school. And I went to the business school of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And it was possibly one of the most liberal business schools in the United States. For example, at the end of each semester, we used to grade the lecturers. They didn't grade us. We students graded the lecturers. Encounter groups were part of the course. In sociology, we chose the subjects that we were going to discuss each week. So this was so liberal, and I started to feel this is worth more than the whole of my 3 years at Cambridge, because you can say what you think, you can have any attitude you like, for capitalism, against capitalism. And it literally blew my mind. Before going to MIT, my politics were sort of middle centre. After leaving MIT, I only stayed there a year, my politics was something to the left of Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, let's just go back to the space programme.
Yes.
What were you doing for them?
Well, I was working on an enormous computer programme, which was working out the optimum flight path that Apollo 1 or 2 would go to put a man on the moon. We were trying to work out the flight path so that the space vehicle could take the maximum payload to the moon. And I had to learn about a thing called the calculus of variations. Well, it was so difficult. The problem was proposed by Leibniz, and it was only solved 10 years later. It was actually, my year working on the spaceship was one of the most boring jobs I've ever done. I actually jumped for joy when I read the acceptance letter for MIT. I'd learnt computer programming in my spare time, and I went up to Boston and got a summer job as a computer programmer.
Let's get back to the brain drain.
Yes. Well, I suppose people were hoping that I would come back. My godfather was hoping that actually I did come back, but I flew back the wrong way around the world, and I visited Japan, Hong Kong, Vietnam while the fighting was still going on, then went to Iran, and I then went to Tito's Yugoslavia, which you've already broadcast my thoughts about. Then I came back to this country on my 30th birthday, and I actually spoke at Speaker's Corner. I spoke about Yugoslavia, and a heckler said, "Look, mate, if you think Yugoslavia is such a nice place, why don't you go and live there?" So then I took a path which absolutely shocked my family. I said, "Look, if I'm going to talk about workers' control, I need some qualification." So for the next 2.5 years, I worked as an assembly worker at the PTA plant at Ford's Dagenham, with the object of trying to become a shop steward. And I did become a shop steward, and it's one of the things I'm most proud of. I was a shop steward for 6 months. I wasn't a very good shop steward because I didn't have the interpersonal skills to do it. But I did once stop the line, which was the ultimate crime at Ford's. I stopped the line through a safety issue. Now, the subject of this talk is whatever happened to British technology. And technology is by and large created by engineers. So we've got to look at engineers in this country, and in particular how they're treated by the establishment. because I hate to say it, but the establishment runs this country. I mean, we've got a Tory party in government for, well, it'll have been in government for 10 years and wrecked parts of the country with things like the bedroom tax. It's the top layer of people who are almost certainly have been to public school. Most of the senior civil servants have been to public school. But they're also the landed gentry, because in this country we have the most iniquitous maldistribution of land. There'd be members of the House of Lords, probably. Some of the Labour members gradually get sucked in to being members of the establishment. And the church as well. Don't let's forget the church. The bishops are in the House of Lords. And for a large part of this history, this country was kept under control by the church. It's nothing like so much now. I don't know what keeps this country under control, possibly the media. The establishment's role in engineering was this, and it was different in wartime to peacetime. Now, in wartime, the establishment regarded engineers as heroes. In the First World War, they were caught napping, and they designed and built tanks, which didn't exist before. In the Second World War, they designed and built aircraft. We all know about the Spitfires and the Hurricanes, and later Whittle designing the jet engine. That was how they were regarded in wartime. They were regarded in wartime as heroes. Now we come to peacetime. And in peacetime, engineers were regarded very differently. They were either ignored, disliked, or regarded as a nuisance. And I'll give you three examples of those. And we have to go back to the 19th century when the railways were being built. The railways had the most colossal effect on the social, political and financial aspects of this country. People who'd been out of work for years suddenly had a job and an income. And what happened, the two principal things, as I see it, were the two great reform acts in 1832 and in 1867, which vastly increased the number of people in the country who had the right to a parliamentary vote. Now, that was a slap in the face of the establishment. But it was followed not long afterwards by the First World War, followed by the Second World War. And then we had the advent of television, which was designed and created and manufactured by engineers. And they found a way to broadcast television signals so that people who had television sets in increasing numbers could see what was going on. And all sorts of things appeared on people's television screens, including live shots of the House of Commons. And during those live shots, they could quite likely see members of Parliament asleep on the back benches. Well, that was a pretty good slap in the face to the establishment, because television vastly increased people's political awareness. They saw politicians being grilled by interviewers. That's the second example. The third example is the 2011 riots. And they were put down almost entirely to social media, which again was designed and put into production by engineers. And the social media enabled people to gather together in numbers so quickly that the police had no power to stop them. They would then perhaps break into a shop, loot it, or even set fire to the shop, as they did in South London. So, frankly, if you look at it and take it bluntly, it was engineers that enabled the 2011 riots. Now, do you blame the establishment for being very wary of engineers after that? If engineers could create riots, well, we'd better watch out. Now, and people have forgotten about this, but the world's first personal computer was invented by someone called Clive Sinclair. He developed it and he put it into production. Now, Clive Sinclair went to the city and he asked for a large sum of money so that he could build a manufacturing facility for personal computers. And my guess was what happened was this. The banker would have said, personal computers, what are they? We don't want everybody to have a personal computer. So Clive Sinclair went back empty-handed, and in frustration he built, actually, a very dangerous electric car, which went into limited production. But the story doesn't stop there, because what happened was the early computers, at the same time the internet was developed, and the establishment realised that a personal computer connected to the internet was the perfect way to keep tabs on the person who was using the computer. So we suddenly had Tony Blair trying to get computers into schools everywhere, massive sums of money on IT programs. And in Cheltenham, we had the development of GCHQ, which was able to scan all emails. That came out in the Snowden revelations. But what was causing the brain drain was how appallingly in this country engineers were treated in peacetime. As I've said, they were either ignored, disliked, or reckoned to be a nuisance. I once went to a party and said, I've got a job making guided missiles. And what happened? The bloke said, come and have a drink at the bar, to get rid of me. It was the low social status of engineers. The institution of electrical engineers was abolished. And I reckon it was because it was too dangerous.
I mean, don't organisations like the Royal Society show some excellence still to this day?
Well, they do, and there's the Institution of Civil Engineers, there's the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. Basically, they're people who are designing motorway bridges, that sort of things. But as we all know, cars, if you drive down a motorway these days, all you see is foreign-designed cars. The British establishment was quite happy with that. What they didn't want to see was British-designed cars, because that meant British engineers gaining skills. And it was that led people to seek jobs abroad. I mean, Australia was crying out for engineers. You could get a £10 passage to Australia. I can remember reading in my professional journal, which was called Engineering and Technology. This is a funny organisation called the Institute for Engineering and Technology, which replaced the Institute of Electrical Engineers. And I can remember an article in it which said, if you're looking for a job, your best bet is to learn a bit of German and go to Germany, where you'll be respected and get a job. Engineering had turned out to be a threat to the established order of this country. It had created the Reform Act in the 19th century. Then there's television, where you saw MPs being ridiculed. And then we had the 2011 riots due to social media.
Do you think that Britain is still producing good engineers that simply aren't getting, maybe they're languishing on the dole or working in call centres?
Well, if there's a graduate engineer listening, someone who's got a degree in engineering, I'd say, look, your best chance for a job is either with GCHQ, who are crying out for software engineers, or with BAE Systems, which make aircraft, missiles and torture equipment and sell them to countries like Saudi Arabia. They're crying out for jobs. If that doesn't work, your best bet is to learn a bit of German and emigrate to Germany or France. Now, what I see in the future is this. This country is an island, and it's absolutely crying out for tidal power. The number of sites in this country that are suitable for tidal power, well, the numbers that I read vary, but there's certainly 8, and I've seen numbers as big as 16. And what's happened is that tidal power has become a great deal cheaper. Rather than having barrages, we've all heard of the Severn Barrage.
Well, they've been talking about that apparently since the 1930s.
Well, exactly, and it's enormously expensive. We hear all sorts of stories that it's going to ruin the wildlife and the fish in the Severn. But we haven't heard much about this. But Nicola Sturgeon is opening a new tidal power facility right on the north of Scotland, where there's extremely strong tides. It's being put in by a consortium of companies. The government's put in a paltry sum, but a lot of it's been raised by a company called Atlantis. And that's what needs to happen all over the country. My view is that I'm not Theresa May. If I was, I'd do 4 things. One is appoint a qualified engineer to my cabinet. There isn't one at all at the moment. 2 is cancel the absurd HS2, which means demolishing a whole chunk of Camden in order to get to the terminus that's being proposed. 3, cancel the extremely dangerous Hinkley Point C. To me, handing the keys of a nuclear power station over to the Chinese is little short of crackpot. And invest the savings from HS2 and Hinkley Point C into a massive development of tidal power. Now, my view is if that's done, that will bring back into this country people who have left with the brain drain. They'll want to be part of this. And Britain will then become a great engineering country again. Look, the problem is the City of London makes so much money by computer-assisted gambling. That's what goes on. The price of gold goes up, so the computer automatically buys gold shares. The price of gold goes down, the computer automatically sells the gold shares and in the process makes a lot of money. So what happens is if some company approaches a bank and say, look, can you give us some start-up funds? It's too much like hard work. They've got to look at the business plan of this company. They've got to meet the people involved, find out what experience they've got. Sorry, but it's much easier to make our millions by the computers churning away in the basement.
David Guinness there, talking about whatever happened to British technology. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic at Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or online at prsc.org.uk. You can also find us on the volunteering websites at Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or online one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the national volunteering site do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Those Blues Wailing God Bullies, that's a track from their Amphetamine Reptile LP War on Everybody, and it's called Magical Butterfly.